the Ahl al-Bayt and perhaps close companions. This included Imam Zayn al-Abidin alayhi salam, the fourth holy Imam, Imam al-Baqir, as well as Imam al-Sadiq, peace and blessings be upon them, the fifth and the sixth Imam. Later, Imams such as Imam al-Hadi and al-Askari, peace and blessings be upon them, also visited the grave of their grandfather, Amir al-Mu'mineen, as well. In the year 75 after Hijrah, al-Hajjaj ibn Yusuf al-Thaqafi ordered that 3,000 graves are exhumed in this area. He wanted to find the body of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Of course, he was unsuccessful. In the era of Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, when the Umayyads were being ousted from the caliphate, there was no longer a reason for the grave of Imam Ali alayhi salam to remain hidden. Due to this, gradually the location of the grave became known and exposed to everyone. It has been narrated that one of the companions of Imam al-Sadiq by the name of Safwan sought permission from Imam to tell the Shi'as of Kufa where the burial place of Imam Ali alayhi salam was. Imam responded in the affirmative and also gave money for the repair and construction of the grave. This was in the year 132 after Hijrah. The narration is told that Safwan al-Jammal said, I was with As-Sadiq, peace be upon him, and we reached Kufa. He said to me, O Safwan, this is the grave of my grandfather Amir al-Mu'mineen. He then performed ghusl, changed his clothes, walked barefoot, and told me to do the same. He said to me, walk slowly with short steps. For every step you take, you'll be granted 100,000 good deeds, and 100,000 sins will be erased, 100,000 status will be raised, and 100,000 wishes and hajat will be fulfilled. Then I walked with him as he was walking with tranquility and humility, remembering Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala through tasbih. At the grave, he gave me permission to inform people of Kufa about the location of where the Imam alayhi salam was buried.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. On this show, we bring reports from all over the world on Zionist attempts to eliminate criticism of its occupation of Palestine. In the US and Canada, the war on solidarity with Palestine is particularly intense. Today, we look at Zionist efforts to suppress free speech and even intimidate public institutions like universities into firing professors who share the majority world view on the need to liberate Palestine. Later in the show, we'll look at other examples of Zionist pressure on free speech. But first, we've got this special report by Bianca Rahimi on how Zionists attacked Stephen Salater, which brought his academic career to a premature end.
Stephen Salater was offered a tenured post at the University of Illinois in late 2013 and was scheduled to take it up in August 2014. However, in July 2014, Salater posted many tweets critical of the Zionist killing spree in Gaza, in which over 2,000 people died. A cherry-picked selection of these were brought to the attention of the university by the press and Zionist groups. First attacks came from William Jacobson, a law professor at Cornell University who works closely with Zionist groups such as the Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting and Analysis. Within days, the Zionist Champaign-Urbana Jewish Federation, which states that among its purposes is supporting the development of Israel, had joined the attack. Rapidly, the university became the focus of a mass Zionist campaign, and it received hundreds of letters from university alumni, students, parents of students, and members of Champaign-Urbana's pro-Israel community, as well as pressure from several large and small donors, threatening to remove funding in the future. Emails that Illinois Chancellor Phyllis Wise exchanged on the case, which were later published, though heavily redacted, reportedly show that she was more concerned about a donor who is on the board of the Jewish Federation and Hillel, two Zionist organizations, than she was about the views of academic officials who report to her. Hillel is the campus organization claiming to represent Jewish students, but which is in fact formally Zionist. Of course, accusations of anti-Semitism were bandied about by the Zionists, but Salaita is not in the least bit racist against Jews. In the end, because of this, they had to find something else to sack him for. Salaita explained, "If there's no serious moral or political argument in response to criticism of Israel, then condemn the speaker for various failures of tone and appropriateness. A word becomes more relevant than an array of war crimes." Salaita later won a court case against the university, which also found that the Chancellor, Phyllis Wise, was involved in tampering with evidence in the case by trying to conceal email messages, and she immediately resigned. A settlement was reached in November 2015, which awarded Salaita $600,000 and an additional $275,000 to cover his legal expenses. He did not, however, get his job back. What does this case tell us about the wider climate? First, as Salaita himself unflinchingly put it, Zionist smear campaigns aim to make you destitute. Despite subsequent job offers, also withdrawn, he was unable to secure another job at a university, and he now drives a school bus in Washington, D.C. He remains, however, an active critic of Zionism. Salaita has published a guide on how to handle a Zionist defamation campaign. His Twitter followers have gone from about 2,000 before his sacking to 10,000 in late 2014, rocketing up to more than 55,000 today. He has published two books since the incident in Illinois, and his spirit remains strong.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog initiative, Spinwatch. We're also joined by Khaled Barakat. Khaled is a Palestinian-Canadian activist and writer. He's a founder member of the No One Is Illegal organisation, which campaigns for the rights of refugees. He was initially deported from the US, then detained in Germany, before being deported and banned from the country for what was described as his rhetoric. Today, he's in a battle to remain in Canada, which has been his and his family's home for around 20 years. And Khaled joins us today from Vancouver, where it's very early in the morning, so we're very grateful to have you here, Khaled, and welcome to the show. David, let me start with you. I mean, there are real parallels, aren't there, in that story that we've just seen on the VT there, with what happened to you, as issues about, you know, concerns about donors to the university. And I think that was a factor in your case, wasn't it, which led to your dismissal from Bristol University.
It was. That was one of the factors. The university had a number of letters from benefactors saying that they would withdraw funds, that they wouldn't give funds that they had previously given, or that they would not give any new funds. And, of course, that was something which they took seriously. It became clear since then that amongst those who had offered to give money and who had previously given money to the university was Gerald Ronson of the Community Security Trust, which was, of course, the organisation which started the campaign to get me fired in the first place. So a very close parallel, I think, and it shows the way in which the tactics used by the lobby, by the Zionist lobby, are replicated all over the world, in America, in the UK, and in other places too.
I mean, Khaled, I wonder if we could ask you to reflect on this case, and And give us your assessment of the situation in Canada right now.
Thank you for the invitation. I think this smear and racist campaign that we are witnessing in Canada, the goal and the objectives behind it is to divert the attention of what's happening in Canada and what's happening in Palestine. They don't want us to speak about the Israeli daily crimes and atrocities against our people in Palestine. And at the same time, they don't want to see the changes and the developments that it's happening here in Canada. We have a growing Palestinian solidarity movement. The student movement in Canada and the universities have been really achieving victories one after another, especially on the front of boycotting Israel and exposing its racist policies and war crimes against Palestinians in Palestine from the river to the sea. And we also see that, the Canadian pro-Israel lobby is actually weak. They are in the defensive, and they're trying to jump into the offensive by criminalizing the Palestinian people's struggle and the Palestinian resistance. That's really why they're doing this. And we think that it's really important that we also see the growing solidarity movement with Palestine globally. Israel cannot get away with its crimes against the Palestinian people, and they have been doing this for the past 74 years.
Absolutely. I mean, David, let me just ask you about this Hillel organization. I mean, what do you know about this organization, and is there a UK equivalent?
Well, Hillel is a very old, long-standing organization, but it comes out of an even older organization. It comes out of this organization called B'nai B'rith, which also set up the Anti-Defamation League in the US, which is the US equivalent of the Community Security Trust, which I mentioned just a little while ago. So it set up Hillel, and Hillel is a student organization. It's formerly part of the Zionist movement, and they have representatives on campuses right across the US. But the UK equivalent, people won't know this, is the Union of Jewish Students.
I was just thinking, right? Actually, yeah.
But the formal name of the Union of Jewish Students, when it's registered at Companies House, is the B'nai B'rith Hillel Foundation.
Interesting.
So we see that this is simply the UK chapter of an international organization, yes, which is itself at the top, registered with the World Zionist Organization, and is formally part of the Zionist movement. These are the things I've been saying for a long, long
Indeed.
Time, and people sort of look at me askance about this. But, these are clear organizational
Indeed.
Links.
Well, very clear from your answer there, David, and the way in which they've registered as an organization. But Khaled, I mean, you've been targeted in three different countries. I mean, is there something to be said for the idea that Israel, or the Israeli regime, is stalking Palestinians across the planet? It certainly seems that way.
Absolutely. I'm not the only one. I mean, there are so many Palestinian activists and writers and even solidarity activists with Palestine, including some of our Jewish comrades who have been attacked severely by the Zionist movement. And they want to criminalize, again, any solidarity with Palestine. And I just want to say that, when they have this list of organizations like Hamas and the PFLP and other Palestinian resistance organizations and Lebanese resistance, we say that we don't accept this, because this is not just criminalizing an organization, but an entire people. We support the Palestinian resistance and the Palestinian and the Lebanese resistance, and we say that publicly. And we are not going to shy away from saying that our struggle is to dismantle this racist regime of Israel. Israel as a state needs to cease to exist, and we need to build an alternative society in Palestine where everyone could live together in peace and harmony and real justice from the river to the sea. I mean, an Israel project as a Western colonization project had failed. It is reaching its peak because they are actually in their peak of strength, and Israel is becoming a total fascist regime that is dangerous to the peace in the region and the world. I think the entire world is watching this and beginning to understand how dangerous Israel is.
I absolutely think that's right, Khaled, and I certainly take your point about anti-Zionist Jewish people being targeted, and you know, many of my friends, anti-Zionist Jews, who were very much targeted by the Zionist lobby. But David, I was struck by the quote there that the Zionist smear campaign aims to sort of make people destitute. I mean, do you agree with that?
Yes, I do. I mean, that's what they were trying to do to me. They've tried to make me destitute. They've chucked me out of a job, a very well-paying job, I have to say, and into what? Nothing. I was immediately cut off from all salary. Now, the result of that has been that I've come back stronger and harder, and perhaps they you know, regret what they've done, because I'm much more of a critic and I have much more time to criticise the movement now than I had then. But that's what they aim to do. They aim to make me, and indeed you, and many other people, destitute, and they want to crush us into the ground. And of course, that's the problem they've got, is that they can't do that, because the resistance lives beyond individuals like me or you, and it is based in and grows from the strength of the resistance actually in Palestine. So they want us to be destitute, but as Khaled has been saying, you know, they are failing, they are reaching the peak, and so they are lashing out and attempting to destroy us, but their power is tenuous.
No, indeed. I mean, my very real sense is that the resistance is indeed growing, as you say. But Khaled, just very briefly, I mean, what's your impression of the strength and the impact of the solidarity in cases like these?
Actually, we are really overwhelmed with the solidarity, support and the support we are getting. I mean, the pro-Israel lobby is very strong in Canada, and yet they are not getting any kind of support on a public level. Yet we are getting the support from the labor movement, from the student movement, from various different, organizations, and people are actually reacting with establishing initiatives such as the Canadian Legal Center for Palestinian Rights here in Canada and other popular initiatives. When the Zionists attack us,
that's very encouraging. That's very encouraging to hear, Khaled, and it's so important, I think, and that, you know, we do need to unite, I think, throughout the world, and it's good to hear that solidarity is working in Canada there. But I just have to pause the discussion there for a moment, because I want to just look at this report on Zionist intimidation that was actually used against Khaled Barakat.
Few Israel lobby campaigns of harassment in the West have had the ferocity of the campaign against Palestinian-Canadian writer Khaled Barakat. First deported from the United States, then detained, deported and banned from Germany merely for rhetoric. Today he's in a battle to remain in Canada, where he's lived with his wife for almost two decades. The anti-Palestinian thrust of German government policy is becoming more and more glaring. From banning all demonstrations of support for Palestinians and a vigil for journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, to cleansing Palestinian employees from the German state broadcaster. The German government even forced the resignation of the director of Berlin's Jewish Museum for a social media post sharing an article about Jewish opposition to anti-BDS legislation in Germany. Khaled Barakat is an academic, an activist, and a founding member of the No One Is Illegal organization, which campaigns for the rights of refugees. A series of actions against him by the German government reveal the spite of this campaign. The vindictive crusade began with an event featuring him being shot down in Germany in June 2019. Following that servile move, the German government then detained, deported, and banned him for 4 years, with the Interior Ministry claiming it was in response to his rhetoric. Since then, he's been legally challenging the German state. The campaign against him has even included Israeli Minister of Strategic Affairs, Gilad Erdan, who wrote a letter to the EU's Parliament's president demanding Khaled Barakat be banned from speaking there too. This attempt by the temporary entity was unsuccessful. Now, Barakat has found himself the target of a coordinated campaign to deport him from Canada, which has been initiated by the Canadian Senate by pro-Israel Senator Leah Houssakos. In the past, Houssakos has publicly celebrated the Nakba and is supported by Israel lobby group B'nai'th B'rith. The target is also to criminalize the Canadian branch of Palestinian Prisoners Solidarity Network, Samidun, which works to support the thousands of Palestinians kidnapped in Israeli dungeons. Take a look at Leah Houssakos slavishly reading from his script about Barakat.
From the United States, he's been barred from Germany. Yet the Trudeau government still allows this individual to remain in Canada, despite Canadian law that forbid any individual with connections to terrorist organizations from entering our country or receiving Canadian citizenship. Why does your government allow him to remain in the country?
Another group working to deport Barakat is the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs, which is led by Shimon Fogel, who claims to have established the shared values strategy supported by the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Khaled Barakat continues to resist this campaign against his freedom. This as he resists the cleansing of his people from Zionist-occupied Palestine. Solidarity with Khaled Barakat.
Khaled, the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs, which is led by Shimon Fogel, who claims to have established the shared value strategy supported by the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs, is working for your deportation, isn't it? What's your opinion on Israel's tactic of using front groups to achieve political objectives?
Yes, these groups work for the interest of Israeli occupation, and they coordinate on a daily basis with the Israeli embassy and Israeli intelligence agencies, and they are saying this publicly themselves. They're not interested in any harmony or peace in Canada. They are interested in working for Israel. They have jobs, and they want to keep their jobs. And because they're losing on the university fronts, on the labor movement, on academia, and, you know, the Israelis are kind of frustrated in Tel Aviv and telling them, you're not doing your job. You have to start, you know, these campaigns against Palestinians and their supporters who are actually, you know, gaining momentum, and their work has been, you know, clarifying the Palestinian struggle objectives and what is the conflict and the real conflict in Palestine. And notice these groups are actually coordinating with each other in the UK, in Australia, in the United States, in Germany, and all the colonized, you know, the colonialist power are the one who is backing them. Germany just banned Palestinian march for return in last May. You know, France is trying to dissolve some of the Palestinian solidarity groups. We have been seeing an attack after another against Samidun because they advocate for the freedom of Palestinian political prisoners. And so it's a battle, and it is not just in Canada, it's globally. And that's because of the nature of the conflict in Palestine. The conflict in Palestine is not just between Palestinians and Israelis. This is a global conflict where the UK responsible, Germany is responsible, France, Canada, UK, every country that supports Israel has a blood on their hands when it comes to this conflict. They are involved in Israeli crimes. When a country like Germany provide nuclear submarines for Israel, when France supports Israeli racism in international arenas, when the United States fully adopt Israel positions and Israeli crimes, including crimes against journalists who have U.S. citizens like Shireen Abu Akleh. When these things happen, the world watches and sees that.
And we covered the horrific murder of Shireen on a previous show. But David, I mean, just on that point, really, I mean, you know, we've covered similar tactics, haven't we, in previous episodes of the show? I mean, and Khaled talked about how these sort of tactics are deployed in other countries around the world. I mean, it's no coincidence, is it? Or is it?
Well, it's not a coincidence, is it? I mean, it's not as if there is a Zionist organization in Canada, one in France, and one in the UK, which accidentally all comes to the same idea at the same time and pursues it. These are coordinated strategies. These organizations, as Carla says, are coordinated. They coordinate with the embassy in their own countries, and they coordinate with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and previously the Ministry of Strategic Affairs. These are a global transnational movement. It's called the Zionist Movement for a reason. It's one set of organizations with different iterations in different countries. Mm-hmm. So, of course, they all have the same strategy. Of course, Stephen's case seems similar to my case. Khaled's case seems similar to many of the other cases we've seen. They are all coordinating. And when Khaled says we have to dismantle the Israeli state, well, I would say, yes, we do, but we also have to dismantle the Zionist movement all over the world. The Zionist movement all over the world plays a major material role in the continuation of the Zionist entity in Palestine today. So we have to disaggregate, decolonize, and deconstruct all of these organizations, and they need to cease to exist. And that's a big, big effort, but that's where we're going.
Yeah, indeed. Khaled, you've been deported from both the US and Germany, and you're now under threat of the same in Canada. What's the involvement of the Zionist lobby in the previous two cases?
Well, actually, in the case of the United States, I was barred from entering the United States, and they confiscated my residency. In the case of Germany, I was deported and banned from entering Germany for 4 years. And we have a case in the German courts, and we're fighting back. We actually just won in March 11th. There was a court, and we won that it was illegal for the German police to ban my event when they prevented me from speaking about, Trump deal of the century. And I was invited by Arab and Palestinian community in Berlin. In the case of Canada, I think we're very hasty by asking for the deportation because I have been a Canadian citizen since 2003. And, if my name was Arnold and I was white with, blue eyes, they would probably not say deport him. But they immediately assume that, I'm probably here on a visa or a temporary, work visa. But I think they're failing on all these fronts because the attempt to, especially on the case of deportation, I mean, I was a co-founder of an organizations and campaigns to fight deportation in Canada and elsewhere, because it is really important that we don't budge these intimidation campaigns and we don't, give in. And as, David said, and you said that these tactics have been really cheap tactics and exposed, and they really reflect a weakness in the Zionist movement. They used to be more organized and more smart. They are not anymore, really. They're losing, and they are nervous.
No, indeed. I was just going to ask you very briefly, Khaled, what you made of the being banned about your rhetoric, but unfortunately we are running out of time, so we have got the ability to ask you that question. So thank you very much indeed to David and to Khaled for joining us today, and we'll be back next week with more investigation and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
We are the 140 million poor and low-wealth people standing together to declare we won't be silent anymore, said Dr. Liz Theoris, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign in the United States of America. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jessica Corbett, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Poverty is Violence. Thousands of Americans demonstrate in D.C. to demand economic justice. Stay tuned for more. Led by Poor People's Campaign, advocacy groups and low-income individuals gathered in Washington, D.C. to demand that policymakers fight poverty, not the poor. We are the 140 million poor and low-wealth people standing together to declare we won't be silent anymore, said Dr. Liz Theoris, co-chair of the campaign, adding, poverty is a policy choice and we will hold our leaders accountable. Fellow campaign co-chair Bishop William Barber echoed that message in a speech at the Mass Poor People and Low-Wage Workers Assembly and Moral Watch on Washington, which drew thousands to the nation's capital. Barber declared that as long as essential workers are treated like they are expendable during a public health crisis, as long as federal lawmakers block pandemic relief for families, as long as Americans have the stealing of native lands and unjust immigration, and as long as millions of people nationwide face hunger and homelessness, we won't be silent anymore, they said. Barber explained, let us be clear, we are not simply here for a day. WHO highlighted voter suppression efforts and the United States' significant military spending, adding, this assembly is to declare the full commitment of a fusion coalition. Now is the time for a third reconstruction. We are the rejected who have been rejected by the politics of trickle-down economics and rejected by neoliberalism, he continued, sharing the history of the first two reconstructions, adding, this is a movement until children are protected, until sick folk are healed, until low-wage workers are paid, until immigrants are treated fairly, until affordable housing is provided, until the atmosphere, the land, and the water are protected, until saving the world and diplomacy and living in peace is more important than blowing up the world. He added, we won't be silent anymore. Participants in the event shared updates on social media with the hashtag MoralAssembly 2022. The event featured testimonies from people like Vivian Henry of Minnesota Poor People's Campaign, who spoke of her fears about losing her Medicaid due to politicians who don't care whether she lives or dies. I'm here to say that if Congress can repeatedly afford to give corporate welfare to the rich, then Congress can afford universal health care for all so that people don't go bankrupt or are forced to use a GoFundMe to cover medical expenses, Henry said, adding, scarcity is a massive lie. My children are survivors just by being alive. It is not enough to be resilient and survive. It is our human right to grow and thrive, declared Maya Torabella, an indigenous mother who spoke at the assembly, followed by her daughter, Katri Dafrin. Describing her experience growing up in Oklahoma, Dafrin said that, although I moved away, I'm still in poverty. I cannot leave poverty. I am a 17-year-old child and my country has already failed me. Kevin Quinn, who traveled to the rally from Nebraska, told North Country Publico Radio that it's a kind of sickening to me that we have come to the capital of the richest country on the planet and we see homeless people in tunnels and living on the streets. And so just to be able to be here and participate is an honor as well as something that's very upsetting. Because here we are, what, 60 years later, and we're still marching for the poor, we still haven't fixed this problem, he added, referencing the 1963 March on Washington, where Dr. Martin Luther King delivered his I Have a Dream speech. Ahead of the assembly, Barber said that people were coming to D.C. to say, not only do we need a moral reset, we represent 32% of the electorate now, poor people do, and 45% of the electorate in battleground states, and it's time for that power to be organized, mobilized, and felt in every election throughout this country.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini l-Islami, dini, wal-Azam ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to talk about the rules of Hajj, in fact, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but In 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hauza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, as always, our guest speaker in the studio. Sheikh Javid, since we are talking about, Hajj and the pilgrimage to God's house or Mecca, let me ask you this question. In fact, due to, for example, some conditions or some, let's say, accidents or events that happened, for example, we know that, for example, since 2019, the whole world has been hit, in fact, by a vicious, in fact, which we call it a virus, which we called it COVID-19. And then it gave rise to a kind of delay in everything or a kind of closure, let's say, on some of the activities, mankind used to do, in fact, all over the earth. And one of them being Hajj, and this pilgrimage, in fact, to Mecca has been somehow closed down or shut down for, let's say, a couple of years. Or it was done, you know, like to a very limited extent or degree by the limitations that was imposed because of that virus. So are there any other things or conditions or whatsoever that by which Hajj can be abandoned?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the light of the verse which I recited in one of the previous episodes, a person who is qualified for Hajj and is well aware that Hajj is obligatory upon him, and if he does not perform it, he has committed a major sin, a great sin, because it is a duty from Allah. وَلِلَّهِ عَلَى النَّاسِ حَجُّ الْبَيْتِ مَنِ اسْتَطَاعَ إِلَيْهِ سَبِيلًا. And this verse is very clear when it, because it denotes that whoever is bodily and physically and financially capable,
right,
he should take immediate action to perform Hajj, you know. Whenever a person feels that he is in a position, you know, he is bodily healthy and he is financially capable, he should take immediate action to perform Hajj. Of course, in this time around, performing Hajj will require a lengthy procedure. He has to enlist himself. He has to pay for it. And of course, visa has to be issued. Mm-hmm. And so it is a time-consuming procedure.
Right.
So the earlier he takes action, the better it is. And he should not sit, sit doing nothing and wait for some opportunity to go to Hajj. That's not permissible. So immediate action is necessary. And of course, based on this verse, those who are bodily and financially capable should perform Hajj. And of course, there are people who are, let's say, financially capable, but they are bodily not capable.
Mm-hmm.
So such people who are financially capable, of course, they should, since they cannot perform Hajj, they should perform it through a proxy.
Uh-huh.
Someone as a representative should right. perform Hajj on their behalf.
I see.
And of course, it's not, exempt. He is not exempted in this scenario.
But if he's not financially capable, then it's then over, of course, right? It's called off.
Yeah, he's no longer supposed to perform Hajj
yes.
because he does not have the means. Okay,
yes.
the means to perform Hajj. And of course, when it comes to the obligation of performing Hajj, or it has been narrated from Imam Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam, who says that if a person dies and does not perform Hajj while there was no pressing need,
right,
severe illness, or any cruel ruler,
right,
who may prevent him from performing it,
mm-hmm.
he will die as a Jew or a Christian, you know. Jews and Christians do not perform Hajj, so he will die as a follower of Judaism or maybe Christianity, but not as a Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
So we understand how tremendously important Hajj is.
I see. Okay, thank you very much. Let's take another break or a short break,
sure.
and we'll be back and continue our topic of Hajj. In fact, in this program, Islamic Law on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Akbar.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about the jurisprudential rules of Hajj according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, before the break, I asked you about some of the conditions or scenarios that may get Hajj, in fact, abandoned.
Yes.
Are there any more on the abandonment of Hajj or the conditions that give rise or may give rise, in fact, to such a scenario?
Well, if there are obstacles like you mentioned, and for example, if there is a widespread disease preventing people from getting together,
yes,
or if the visa is not issued, as long as you're not guilty,
mm-hmm.
you cannot do anything about it.
Right,
because everything is not in your hand.
Right.
You want to take action, you want to perform Hajj, but there are hindrances, there are obstacles, there mm-hmm. are problems, which cannot be resolved easily. So just in the past, as in the past 2 years, for example, millions of Muslims failed to show up in Mecca,
yes,
and to perform the pilgrimage of the house of God. So they are not to blame in this case.
Right. What about the financial capability that you've been talking about before the break? You know, if somebody, can go to Hajj on condition that, in fact, he takes a loan out of a bank or a friend or whatever, does that make that person, if he does so, prone to making such an attempt or a journey?
Well, if a person takes or receives a loan from someone or from a government institution or a bank or a firm, it's okay. He can take it, but he will not be qualified. He will
uh-huh.
not be capable of performing Hajj. He can perform Hajj using the borrowed money, but it will not be counted as obligatory Hajj.
Mm-hmm.
So it will not be Hajjatul Islam or the obligatory Hajj. It will be counted as a recommended Hajj.
Huh?
And of course, when it comes to performing obligatory Hajj, one should not owe anyone anything, any
mm-hmm.
money, and he should not have any liability, whether it is towards an individual or a government institution or a bank, you know, a government, yes, or a private bank, and it does not make any difference. One should clear his liabilities and debts, whatever, to people, to organizations, and then he can perform an obligatory Hajj.
When you're talking about financial ability, how much are we talking about?
Financial ability means that a person has enough money to perform, to embark on a Hajj journey, and he has enough money to support his family back in his hometown. And then when he comes back, he will not be under complete, you know, financial constraint.
Or in poverty.
Or poverty, yes. So if he has the expenses and he goes on a journey and he has the provision left for his family, and then on return he has, for example, enough to provide for his family, for his children, for his kids, then he is considered to be a qualified and capable person.
Not a lot of people have ready cash, you know, but they do have, for example, immovable stuff like house, for example. So does that make that individual, in fact, qualified to
go to house? A house is something that you need. Everybody needs a house. It's the most basic thing that everybody should have.
Right.
And you cannot sell your house and perform Hajj because you cannot make yourself poor or, you know, vulnerable by selling your, you know, by making things difficult for you, yourself, for your family.
But if you have two houses?
If you have two houses, of course, you should sell one and you will be capable. So in that case, you will have to take action for Hajj.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Abid, for your nice answers to the questions regarding Hajj, according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. In the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We leave you an al-Azkir and please pray for us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.